What up, power shifters? This is attempt number three to start this podcast. This is Matt.
And this is Nathan.
Yeah, I was having some technical difficulties there with the phone. I looked down and the VU meter was not moving at all. And I'm like, huh?
Yep.
Well, guys, we have a wide array of subjects to cover. Thankfully, we noticed that just 2 minutes in. But, yeah, we're going to kind of talk about a reader email Nathan got that was pretty awesome. Dodge is going to be unveiling something at SEMA, so I think we're going to speculate.
Going over reader email, which we didn't get to cover last week since we were on the road.
Yeah, that was... Yeah, we were on the road taking the E90 down to Bruce, bringing the F10 back. Shameless plug for anybody who wants to know about the F10. I have a really nice article on the website on powershiftmedia.net. Drove the car about 130 miles home. Love the car. Yeah, Nate's working on that. So, what are you kind of doing on that thing?
Yeah, I mean, we've done a catless downpipe on it. A little bit of R&D in that aspect, doing some pie cut work. I guess that pretty much coupled with the, with a quick flash tune was good for like 30 some horse, I think, to the wheels.
Just the downpipe itself, most aftermarket will say good for 30 a wheel on the N55. The N55 tunes are good for like 80.
Yeah.
The way the car is now, it's basically 110 wheel over what the car would have been stock. And then he's doing...
Getting ready to pull it apart, send the turbo out to get upgraded. It is getting a new billet wheel and the compressor housing machined out to accept the billet wheel. And that one was good for how many horse?
70 wheel. So basically the car would be right at about over 200 wheel over stock, which is a good sweet spot because the N55s do have a cast crank. I think Bruce said they're good for about 550 or so. But it was kind of funny because we went over some tracks and the car's low. Nate has lowered the car. It's got really nice Boston wheels on it. He jumped way ahead of me in the F-250 because he can just sail over tracks. And here I am getting an angle, making sure I ain't rubbing nothing. You put about a quarter mile on me and I put it down into M1. And it has the most aggressive MHD tune on the trans and all that. And I put it down on first, and literally, as soon as I gut stomped it, it was ready for second. So it was, wah, just literally that quick, and I was doing 85 mile an hour, and I had sucked Nathan's bumper right back up. And I texted him, like, man, this car would probably run high 12s. I almost guarantee it. And then 10 minutes later, Bruce texts me, and he goes, I think I could get a high 12 out of that. And I'm like, I feel like up at Norwalk, I could get a 1290 out of that thing. It runs real well.
It'll hook and go.
It does. If it has any wheel spin, I definitely never found it. And I even kind of hit a couple corners with it, you know, some good speed. And, man, that car's just a good all-arounder for such a big car.
Mm-hmm.
Love that car. If you're wanting a bigger body luxury car and you got about 13 to spend, the 535 X-Drive is not a bad way to spend your money.
No, not at all. Put some wheels, do a little bit of tune work.
Nice.
Do a shameless plug as well. If you need the catless downpipe, hit me up. I can do those fairly easy, crank it out in, you know, a few hours. So
honestly, any of that stuff, I mean, BMW and BMW land aftermarket's very pricey, so anything you need fabricated, Nathan's definitely the guy to go to. He's done the rear sway bar on the Mirage, the strut bar. Next weekend, we're going to probably be doing our podcast in the middle of constructing the new front sway bar for it.
That's going to be a little bit more challenging for sure. I think we'll nail it.
Oh, yeah, we always do. That one's been kind of a challenge, but I guess to kind of delve into that a little bit, you know, designing the sway bar is hard enough, but at that point, you know, my stock bar is probably 16, 17 millimeters. We're going to a 25.4 millimeter. At that point, you need new bushings. You don't want to use a really good beefy sway bar with stock soft end link, so I've had to do a lot of homework. We actually just measured the end link, and thankfully, it uses like the old school style through bolt end link. Not like the Heim joint style, but just a through bolt with grommets that hold the bushing, so... Based on measurements, I found a set of energy suspension ones that are going to work. Anybody in the Mirage community listening, I know a couple of you guys do, are when we sell this as a kit, it will include not only those polyurethane end links with the new bolt and everything, we will also include the 1-inch diameter polyurethane sway bar bushings with mounts. So when we have it as a kit, it's all inclusive. I mean, poly bushings, poly end links.
Mm-hmm.
It's really going to tighten it up a lot. Nathan actually just drove the car.
I was really, really impressed with it. Actually, you'll see it in our video of our steering wheel change out video. So if you are interested in checking out what it takes to pull a steering wheel and change it out in a Mirage, be sure to check it out on YouTube. And I actually talked just a little bit towards the end of the video of me, my experience getting to drive it how it is. You would think that, I mean, it's definitely no performance sports car, but for the modifications that you've actually done to it, it surprised the crap out of me. The steering feels very E90-esque, and the car actually handles very well. Going from the passenger seat to the driver's seat is totally different experience, where it's nice to sit in the passenger seat when developing parts because you're more likely to feel what the car is doing, you know, not being in control and being able to handle the steering wheel to support yourself. So that's where when we're driving, I can really feel the need for a front sway bar. Where exactly. I was driving it, you can still tell, but you couldn't quite tell as much. But
yeah, like when you're driving it, it is weird because I hadn't ridden passenger in that car for like 7 months. So yeah, when Nate was driving it, he kind of, you know, kind of mopped that one corner a little bit. And it does feel very different in the passenger seat.
Yeah.
But you had the same impression I do. And honestly, this is a high praise for the car. It's still on 165 tires.
Little teeny tiny tires.
Yeah, 14s, 165, 70, 14s, still on stock shocks and springs. And I will say, as the car sits right now, it feels every bit as good as the bone stock Veloster did. I would say they're right on par, but the Veloster suspension was obviously much stiffer. But in terms of cornering potential speed, I could probably have kept up with the stock one now.
Yeah.
And that's really high praise because that was a very good handling car stock. Once I put the Advan Novoas I'm looking at on it, the RPF1s, and the very custom coilovers.
Getting your seats in there, dropping the center of gravity even more.
I have a feeling this car is going to be on rails based on the changes we've made. And
from what we read about the guy that did do more autocross-oriented, you know, stuff on his car,
he was doing real well.
We may even get into doing maybe some different control arm geometry and making something along those lines that allows for a wider track width, too, to, you know, kind of help it.
It's kind of what I was thinking. I mean, I've gotten a whole lot of love on this project, and ironically, in the Mirage community, some hate. You know, in the community I'm basically trying to support with our parts, you know, some of them like to make some snide comments, which, you know, I never...
To be expected.
Yeah, I never much care about, but a lot of the actual racing community is really embracing what it is we're doing. I mean, right now, tentatively, we're going to get the front sway bar done, and probably going to build the front and rear crash supports, because I have found weights. There's, between the two, they're about 64 pounds, and I think we can engineer both at about 24 pounds combined. And then there's the factory cross member, which is basically this big piece of iron.
Right.
So I'd like to engineer that in chromoly to really stiffen that up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to be an integrated brace. So just bracing that part of the car. And then, yeah, maybe looking into some control arms. And I guess that dives into some good racing talk. I was actually looking at spherical bearings, but decided against it because I was talking with a couple guys who've been doing it a long time. And they say spherical bearings are basically the shit for racing. But they have a really short life.
Yeah, they get any kind of grit and dirt inside of them, they just wear out super fast.
And the other problem is they're so good at doing their job, they really beat the crap out of the wheel bearings. So everybody said, you know, if you have a car that's basically a 24-hour car, and you know you're going to do your wheel bearings and update those bearings every race, they make all the sense. But if you kind of want to set it and forget it, poly is the way to go. So that's the direction we're going to take that.
Yep.
As far as subframe bushings, yeah, I mean, you can go stiff on those, but when those control arms are just that rigid, then your wheel bearings basically kind of take up the rest of that energy. And, you know, we don't really want that, so. But I'm going to be looking at getting a beater. Just a good car to drive around, kind of have an idea. But as soon as I pick up a beater, the Mirage is going to be staying here at Nate's house. And we're going to be doing some cool interior mods on it that we've talked about. Ripping all the wiring out of the car. I've decided to go with the Haltech 1500 standalone for several reasons. And we're going to be seam welding in at that time. That's when all the big stuff's going to be happening. Boost and standalone. Probably going to some like LS2 coils just to get some more fire in that ignition. Something else before I forget I want to mention. In the video, yeah, I kind of throw the Mirage community a bone. And it's been asked a million times, you know, can you put an aftermarket wheel in the car? Yes, you can. I even dropped the part number for it. But what we're going to do is in the link in our YouTube, we're going to have links. Proud to announce we are now Amazon affiliates. So if there's been tools you've seen Nathan use that you would like to own, or, you know, for example, the NRG short hub and quick release I've used, we're going to have links there. So if you guys want to buy them, you know, do us a favor and use our affiliate links. It really helps this podcast a lot to grow, to get better.
Do cool stuff.
Exactly. And we definitely appreciate anybody who does. If there's things you guys are interested in, let us know. We'll drop an affiliate link to you. But in the meantime, yeah, I think that steering wheel video is going to be a lot of fun because as far as we know, we are the first to ever do it. So we're Renegade Performance for a reason. We are the renegades, especially of this platform. We're the first. So we don't really know where this road's going to lead. I know Haltech was helpful with the standalone thing. I'll be announcing that down the road, but have some exciting news about that. I appreciate Haltech very much. They've taken a huge interest to this project.
I'm extremely excited to learn the tuning aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, obviously we know DSM Link. You really know the like the VE and the speed density stuff. And yeah, the Mirage is going to be a speed density car, meaning it's not going to have the MAF anymore. We're going to be running a MAP sensor and some boost pressure through it. So I'm hoping to hit 150 on the stock engine. I'd be real happy with that, honestly.
In all reality, 50 horses cylinder, that's...
I think it would be right at, because they do have cast pistons and crank and rods. So I think that's a good number for it. And that's something else I, you know, kind of wanted to bring up. The blocks are open deck.
Yeah.
So I have found it is an open deck aluminum block. The whole engine itself without accessories weighs like 112 pounds. I have been talking with Darton about getting some mid sleeves made up that will close the deck of the block.
Nice.
So when people ask, how hard are you trying to go? That's a good indicator. I'm already looking at sleeving my block. So I'm looking to take this thing pretty far. I want it to be durable and racing. I do want to, you know, a point down the road push a lot of boost pressure through it. Oh, yeah, it's going to be awesome. Yeah, I mean, if it's sleeved and has the proper rods and pistons in it, I mean, sky's the limit at that point. Mm-hmm. We can really push the platform, but...
I like how it takes the aspect of, like, the Japanese key cars.
Yes.
That it's, like, right down that alley, but with, you know, a newer car. And it just, we'll be able to put our own twist on it, but pay, you know, homage to that, I guess, that genre of modifying cars.
Yeah, that's exactly why I like it. I love smaller, lightweight cars. I mean, it's perfect. And I like the idea of once I get the spare parts car. I mean, we're going to be manual transmission swapping this car. I'm going to have a spare engine on a stand. And once that spare engine has been solidified to my liking, we actually intend to push the limits of the stock engine. And
oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I know I'm going to throw a route through the block eventually. But for the some of the same community that likes to kind of poke fun, well... You'll enjoy it when you want to replicate what it is I'm doing, and you'll now know where that limit is. I don't know where it's going to be. I don't know if it's going to be 180, might be 300.
You never know.
Some open deck blocks like B16s take a whole lot of punishment. So, gonna learn today.
I'm excited to find out. Yeah. And it's gonna be helpful that we're gonna have such a good company supporting us as well with the Hall Tech. So if we have any questions, we've already come to find out that the MyVec system is the same MyVec in Evo 9. So
sure is.
You know, we'll be able to take that kind of information that's already known and plug it into the tune on this car, so it won't be completely, you know, out of the blue, or, you know, finding, you know, our own path. So, I mean, we'll be able to move in that aspect. So I really think that it'll be pretty much straightforward for, you know, doing the wiring. That'll be the hardest part, the actual tuning aspect of it. I think, you know, that'll kind of go hand in hand with them already knowing so much about how to tune MyVec.
Yeah, and Hall Tech's, you know, I really got to shout them out. For anybody who hears background noise, we do have about a 95-pound pit bull chewing
Keeps
on a bone.
Dropping his bone on the
floor. But Hall Tech is, they're super good. I mean, they had told me, you know, you're going to lose most of your CAN systems in the car, which is the communication network within the car. So, good chance I'm going to lose my electric power steering. Good chance I'm going to lose a lot of the functionality the car has. One thing they told me, you know, there's a way to retain the backup camera. And there's actually going to be a way to... Hall Tech has a feature that can integrate the stock push button start stop. They say BMW guys always utilize it. So my car does have the Mitsubishi Fast Key. I will not lose that functionality. And they said, once you guys go to set it up, give us a call. We can help you out with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's awesome. You know, they're going to kind of go out of their way to help, but they were really, like, surprised when they asked what it was we were working on, and needless to say, they want to see a Hall Tech in this car. So, again, in a couple weeks, I'll kind of be announcing that, because I'm going to be buying it. It's going to not only have a Hall Tech ECU, but a full Hall Tech gauge cluster as well.
Oh, yes.
So, when I say I'm trying to go hard in the paint, I'm not joking around. You know, this car is going to be very focused on two things. Looking very nice and going around a corner as fast as possible.
It'll do it.
Oh, yeah. I think so, too.
Just the way that it feels on those teeny tiny, you know, pizza cutter wheels.
We're going to be upping the width of those by almost basically approximately 60%.
Right.
So that's going to give us a lot more track anyway. And the beauty of that is we're not moving up in weight either. The RPF1s with the tires weigh the exact same amount as those tiny alloys.
Yeah.
And that's the things you have to think about on a build like this. You can't just throw the cheapest, wider wheels and tires you can. Yeah, it's going to feel better, but you just brought up your unsprung weight.
Mm-hmm.
It's more stress on your suspension. That's more stress on your wheel bearings. That's performance lost.
Yep.
You got to really think about your weights when you're working with three cylinders in a car this small. Everything you do has kind of an equal and opposite reaction. So you have to, if you added weight here, you know, we've added some weight in bracing the car. That's where you have to take it away in other places, like the crash supports. And that stock wheel with the airbag probably weighed about 4 pounds, and the whole rig we just put in it easily weighed under a pound.
Right.
It sounds stupid and insubstantial, but those things add up. Well, anybody who builds these kind of cars, they'll tell you, some of these guys go with titanium fasteners to save 3 pounds throughout the
gun. Not only that, gun-drilled titanium fasteners just to save those extra few ounces.
Porsche used to, and it's, you know, fun lore for people that don't know, but if you know your 911s, all keyholes are on the left side, left of the steering wheel every time, because these were originally rally cars. A lot of times the doors were welded shut and they'd jump in through the window so they could start the car faster.
Mm-hmm.
A Porsche used to drill like 6 speed holes on the top of the key. That's how far people take it. They were drilling holes in the key itself in the top just to save those extra 50 grams. I mean, I'm not the only one who's really weight-focused. Lotus, Porsche, it goes back decades.
Yep.
So I kind of take some inspiration from a lot of that. And when you're trying to extract everything you can out of a car that, you know, starts off with 78 horsepower, you have to put that thought into it.
Yep. And that's where it's easy to go into this saying, oh, well, why don't you just buy something that starts out with more power? Or, you know, there's so many cars available nowadays that have so much power for, you know, not that much money invested up front. But this kind of goes back in the day where it doesn't always need huge power to go fast. You're focusing on the weight and the handling of the car to go fast around a track or corners. It's not just all about all out straight line, you know, outpacing the other car. It's not about that in this kind of build.
No, basically just taking kind of an AE86 approach. Anybody who's seen the killer AE86 builds, 225 horse in those cars is very fast. And, I mean, Lotus, the Elises are some of the fastest cars around a track, and the Elises in Europe had 190 horsepower. I mean, they were light, they had a short wheelbase. It's all about utilizing what you've got. I mean, yeah, I could have easily, not to sound unhumble because I'm not like that at all, but I could have easily went out and bought a new Civic Type R. I could have had a Focus RS. I could have had any of those cars I wanted to start with. I originally bought the Mirage as a good daily to my Talon. I started taking an interest in modding the Mirage because I couldn't get out of my head the fact it weighs 2,180 pounds full weight, and I'm just like, this car deserves more than daily driver status. Mm-hmm. I think there's more here. And as we've done the mods, it's showing me, yeah, I've made a good decision. it's a fun car to play around with.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm enjoying the crap out of it. But yeah, definitely stay tuned. As soon as I get my beater, you're going to start seeing the car actually get dismantled pretty heavily. You're going to see a whole lot of things come out of it that are never going back. And, yeah, I mean, by the time we have it boosted and seats back in, and I'd love to see the car ride about 1,900 pounds, and I think we can do it with the manual swap pretty easy.
Oh, so, yeah.
If I could have, you know, around 240 horse, 1,900 pounds, you guys will see exactly why I've done this, because it's going to speak for itself. It's just, it's a lot of fun, and something we're both enjoying, you know?
Yeah,
it's a cool car to play around with. And it does get compliments. I actually had somebody ask me the other day about the rear diffusers. He's like, oh, that looks cool. I was at the gas station, and I kind of explained why I did it. He's like, oh, that's cool.
Yep.
So, before, the car was very forgettable. But, man, we heard some news and seen it on Facebook. Dodge has a car under a car cover that just says, SEMA, you know, last year was a great deal of fun. Just wait until this year. We could make out it had a pretty, you know, bulgous hood scoop on it. There's definitely hood pins in the silhouette of the car. There's a lot of speculation on what it is.
The background of the picture was white.
Exactly. And it's confusing because there was a rumor that had some pretty good backing to it that Dodge may bring out a Challenger ACR. Which makes all the sense because the Viper don't exist anymore. And, you know, astute listeners of the podcast will know years back, we kind of asked that question of why does Dodge not build a handling-focused Challenger? An ACR makes a lot of sense. I can't say that this is the ACR, but for me, and I know Austin will be listening, probably punching holes in his drywall because we had a pretty good debate on Facebook, but I think it might be the ACR. I really do. When I think of Dodge and ACRs, they don't do much with the body aside from some aggressive aero. Obviously, interior, you know, the Vipers had the Sebelt seats and stuff and the wing. I wonder if it's that.
I don't know. It's hard to say. It could be many different things because they've had the 426 Hemi as a crate option. I know in the drag pack Challengers, you could get the 426. I don't remember the exact combination. I don't think it was all motor. I think it was supercharged, but I might be wrong. I know they offered the smaller the 392 or 396 or something like that. It was a weird, it was an oddball size, but it was the supercharged version that you could get in the drag pack. Then they had the 426, which might have been all motor, but I don't remember. But I, my speculation being a white background, 1970, if you're familiar with the Vanishing Point movie.
Kind of thought the same.
That Challenger was an RT. It was never actually said whether it was a 440 car or if it was a Hemi car. However, I think possibly with the white background, it could be like a Kowalski tribute car with possibly a 426 Hemi in it. Offer a 426 naturally aspirated and with hood pins and just pay homage to that. I think that's what it is, but I know I'd be off.
For anybody who hasn't seen that movie, it's definitely worth watching. It's kind of a cult icon, especially amongst the Mopar community. Yeah, that car was really well known, the Kowalski Challenger, and it was like basically the main character of that movie, honestly. Mm-hmm. That car really was, and it'd be kind of cool if that was that. I hope it's something like that. Austin thinks it might be a TA version of the Hellcat, which would be pretty awesome if it was. You know, I wouldn't be against that, as long as they actually take steps to make it handle better. Again, my only complaint about the Hellcat cars was they just, it's not even necessarily a complaint, you know it going in, they just don't handle great.
Right.
You know, they are quite cumbersome around corners. So, if they could maybe cut 500 pounds out of that car, you know.
That's the thing, though. The consumer versus what we would like versus what the consumer wants. We were just talking about this earlier.
That is true, but Dodge is good about giving it to us, though. Yeah. They always
have
been.
It's like the thing. Like, just like my dad's 1320, from the factory, the 1320 Scat Pack does not have the passenger seat and does not have the rear seat. They are $1 options. But I don't think that I've ever seen where anybody has actually got their car without the seats just because of that simple fact that, oh, well, I can have the seats for a dollar. There's nobody that wants to buy a car nowadays that doesn't have power seats, doesn't have the heated seats, doesn't have seats.
Right. No, I agree with that.
That's the consumer is ruining that for people. There's not many people out there. Not saying that they didn't sell any like that, but I guarantee it was very few and far in between versus the cars that actually got the seats for $2 extra.
The only reason I think there is hope is this. I mean, if I bought one, I would buy it with the seats, and I just pulled them out myself right. So I had the seats. Mm-hmm. But when Ford brought out the GT350R, it had a backseat delete and a factory roll cage option, and people actually did option that. Obviously, Dodge with the ACR Vipers, those cars had cages in them and were quite impractical, but people still bought them. So, you know, there is a Hellcat for everybody. And or a Challenger period for everybody. So to make one for people like us, to me, makes sense. Yeah, they might not sell a great deal of them, but somebody like you or I would mm-hmm. prefer that car over the more Luxo barge cars. I mean, don't get me wrong, the luxury of the cars is, it's awesome.
Mm-hmm.
But if I could have it with that handling and that power, oh, God, no way. That's the one I'd have to have. I don't care how abrasive it is.
And even, I think, it doesn't even have to have the Hellcat engine. If it handles extremely well, the 485 horse would be perfectly fine.
It would. If you took 500 pounds out of a Scat Pack, that car would roll.
And that's what the TA was supposed to be. It had the bigger brakes. It had the spherical end links and
yes.
different stuff like that. But I don't think it ever caught on because
it's going to be a little bit harsher.
Yeah, it's going to be harsher. Not many people wanted that for a daily driver. And to be honest, not many people that are looking for a handling-focused car or looking into a Dodge Challenger.
True.
So I think that, not that it was a flop, but I think that it was an underappreciated package.
I think Ford really showed the world that you could take a car known for its straight line, you know, prowess, and turn it into a serious sports car with the GT350. Because those things were marked up almost double, and they were selling them. And I gotta tell you, I have never got to experience the R, and I wish I can, but I just can't. But just playing around with a GT350, it's not just good for a Mustang. That car is good, period. It is amazing. And with that magnetic suspension, man, the technology is great. It still rides really well. I mean, you can tell it's a harsh car, but that thing is killer. And Ford just showed people, yeah, they will buy the model that already exists, but here's the handling focus version of that car. So to be able to get that with the lines of the Challenger would be awesome. Because to me, a car like the GT350 makes all the sense. It really does. I mean, I'd buy one in 2 seconds. And I'm not a big fan of the S550. I'm really not. But that one pulls off that look really well with that aggressive splitter in the wing. And I can't say enough good about it. So I kind of hope Dodge takes a page out of that book.
Yeah, I mean, I hope so. I just don't know, because the hype of the Challenger is it's just heavy. I know that the new GT500 is only 200 pounds off of a Hellcat.
ZL1's like 80. It's within 80 pounds.
So it's just, I think everybody has a preconceived notion, just like with DSMs. They're preconceived to be unreliable. You know, anything like that. Over the years, they've just been talked about in that aspect where I think it hurts them. No, if they're going to try and, I don't necessarily think they would try and profit hugely off of it, but even for the guys that, you know, that would cross shop the Mustang and the Camaro and the Challenger for a handling vehicle, I think, and I say this reluctantly because I'm a huge Dodge guy and I would choose the Dodge.
Of course.
But I just think that somebody is going to see a Camaro or, you know, a Mustang as a smaller body car, so, oh, it has to be lighter. I think it's going to be that preconceived notion that, and that's what's going to happen most of the time, where if they do bring out an ACR Challenger, it's just going to be strictly the guy. It's almost going to be like the GT350R, where they're going to have those few guys that know what they're used for, and that's going to be who they're targeting. It's not going to be a general, you know, to the public, they're going to buy a crap load of them. I don't see that happening.
No, I think it makes sense, though, just to bring up the brand image for sure. I mean, Dodge might be asking themselves, how do we take this 4,300-pound car and lighten it up? And honestly, to me, it's simple. The heaviest part of that car is that damn engine block. I mean, we lifted that 5.7 Hemi for the 300. That is the heaviest engine I've ever lifted. So if you're not trying to boost it, and, you know, obviously ACRs, aside from the SRT4, were traditionally all, you know, naturally aspirated, I think it makes perfect sense to build an aluminum block 426. That right there would cut a lot of weight out of the nose of the car. And then, you know, maybe engineer some chromoly control arms and, you know, a tubular, you know, cross member. And to me, right there, that's like 400 pounds right there you could pull out of that car. And maybe offer it without the back seat like ACRs traditionally do. And I mean, that's probably about a 500-pound saving. Now you have a 3,700-pound Challenger, and that's right on par with an M3.
Right.
Current M3s are right about there, so.
That'd be hard to shave that much weight, though.
I think just doing the engine block, cutting down on the ancillary components of the engine, and
they would have to almost go to like a carbon ceramic brake setup and then like a carbon wheel. And
be worth it. Because, I mean, Ford did it and it worked out really well.
Right.
I don't see any reason not to do it, honestly.
Oh, I don't either. It's just going to be selling it. Not that you're not going to have your diehard guys that will, you know, pay no matter what, but
I think
your normal consumer, they're just going to be like, oh, it's just a glorified, you know, scat pack.
I think they should do like Ford did and offer a limited run of like 500 of them right off the rip.
See, to me, that makes sense.
Yes,
but not
limited edition, 500. maybe do an aluminum chassis on it. I mean, even if the car, Dodge has shown people will pay a premium for these versions of these cars. Mm-hmm. The Demon with markup, those things are going like 150, and they nobody batted an eye. I think they're
still now 150, 160,000.
So priced at about 125, aluminum space frame chassis. If you could get that car down to 3,500, I mean, I'm sorry, 3,700 with about 550 horse out of a good all motor Hemi. That thing would fucking roll, would it not?
Could you imagine a flat plane Hemi?
Yeah, that's what like I'm getting at. A small
displacement, because that's what the...
Dodge has to at this point. Like
the AAR Cudas and the TAs, I think they were limited. That class was limited to 350 cubic inch.
I think Dodge has to, honestly, because the Voodoo exists, which is Ford's 5.2 flat plane, and it is so good.
I wonder how well a flat plane crank would work with an in-block cam versus, like, the modular-style motor.
Well, some guys have done the conversions on LSs. I have seen that done.
A high-revving, you know, keep it right at that... right around the 5.7 liter, but do a flat plane crank and bump up the compression.
Even if they went to rev. Overhead cams, it would make sense. I mean, right now the C8 has an in-block cam, just like LS's before it, but there's been a lot of speculation that it may go to a flat plane crank. There was a hell of a lot of speculation the C8R has overhead cams and a flat plane crank. So if Chevy rolls that into like a ZR1, well now Ford and GM have that. Dodge is going to have that somewhere if they want to stay relevant.
Yeah.
And to me, an ACR flat plane crank, even with overhead cams, like it turn 8,000 RPMs. It makes sense. And for anybody who's like, I don't know, just go drive a GT350 and come back and tell me what you think of that, because close your eyes for a minute, it feels like you're in a very nice European sports car, and it's just great. it's hard to put into words, as good as I am at that. It just feels right, and it's like, I'm in a Mustang, but it's doing this.
Right.
And I would love that in a Challenger. It just, to me, that is the ultimate game over car for the Americans. The C8 is going to be a tough act to follow, so if Dodge really does want to still have a huge market share up there, they're going to need it, you know?
Yeah, they're going to have to develop some kind of handling-oriented vehicle, because as of right now, they don't have anything.
The base C8 will turn basically the same 0-60 time as a Hellcat, the base C8. And everybody knows I'm hard on GM, but you can't take that away from them. It's doing 0-60 in like 3.6 seconds as a base car.
It's crazy to think about it, that right now Dodge's Halo car is a Hellcat Red Eye.
Yeah, it really is. And
not that it doesn't have straight line, just all out brawn, but...
Well, those are quoted to do 0-60 in 3.6 seconds in normal conditions. That's what Dodge quotes. If you are careful with the car and, you do a little bit of tire wear on it by getting heat in them, you can cut a 3.10-60 with it. I can tell you firsthand it will do it. But here's my big thing. If a base C8 is doing it in like 3.6, we still have the Grand Sport to worry about. Then the Z06, then the ZR1 C7 was doing it. I actually just watched the Grand Tour episode last night, because it had been forever. Jeremy Clarkson quoted it, the C7 ZR1 in 2.8 seconds.
Yeah.
So the C8 with the engine in the ass of the car, that might become like the fastest production car, literally. It has that potential. Dodge is going to have to either bring the Viper back, bring out a whole new car that's middle engined, or they're really going to have to set up the Challenger just right.
I don't know if the Challenger can do it.
I don't think it can, honestly.
At this point, it's a 10-year-old platform. Not to say that you can't re-engineer the suspension and the chassis work on it.
You can only go so far with it.
Yeah, it's still a 10-year-old platform. It's great. It's proven itself in a straight line over and over. But we've yet to see a handling-oriented vehicle from Dodge in the Challenger lineup, or even the Charger at that.
I think we're just at the limit of what a front-engine rear-wheel drive car can do. I mean, I think the farthest that anybody has really taken it, honestly, is, you know, not just like drag focused cars, but the C7 ZR1 is a good example. 750 horsepower, or the Ferrari 812 Superfast. That was a front engine V12, mm-hmm. Rear wheel drive, and it sounds mostly undrivable. From everything I've heard, it is a very undrivable car at lower speeds.
Do you think that's why Dodge axed the Viper, or was it just sales? Because clearly the Viper still has records that stand to this day.
I think part of it was they reached the limitation on the platform. Sales weren't quite there, which still blows my mind because it was a cheap car for what it was.
Right.
And I mean, where do you take it from there? And not only that, you know, how do you continue to get it to pass emissions in this increasingly... I was like, Ferrari can get away with it because it's Ferrari. They're really low volume.
Yeah.
Lamborghini even had to, you know, go to, like, their first boosted engine using the Urus. I don't know how much longer we're going to get away with it, honestly. It's not long for this world, I don't think.
Yeah, that's... One thing that I don't understand with Dodge, they shouldn't have gotten rid of it. They should have kept it, even though it was only going to be, a limited production, where, like GM did with the Corvette. They took a car that's been produced and, you know, a front engine rear wheel drive for how many
decades? It was since, like, I think 1954 was the first 53, year.
53, somewhere
it was,
in there.
Yeah, it was somewhere there. Red Foreman had one on that 70s show, like that era of Corvette.
And then they had the balls to completely change the platform of that vehicle and continue to call it a Corvette. So why have Dodge just kept the Viper? Obviously, the name had been synonymous with Dodge from the early 90s all the way until now, and then they just dropped it off like it just wasn't anything anymore.
It makes me wonder if they didn't realize where they were going to go with the Challenger and didn't want to have cannibalization of sales, right. But I fucking hate that. Who gives a shit if sales are being cannibalized if you're still selling cars? I never understood that logic.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, can't make the Focus too fast. It'll cannibalize Mustang sales. Who gives a shit?
Same way with the SVO Mustang back in the day.
Yeah. Give people what they want. You know what I mean? Same with Porsche. Oh, we're not going to put a GT3 engine in a Boxster or a Cayman because 911. Just give people what they want.
It's all... There's nothing to do with the car enthusiast that aspect. It's all greed then.
Yeah.
Why give somebody that can't afford the Halo car a car that can perform with it?
Because, and even if they can, honestly, and this is me being super honest, if I could afford a GT3 RS 911 or I could afford a Cayman, you know, GT3 variant like that, I'd rather have the Cayman because I like that smaller platform, even though I fit in it like shit. I would put up with it if I could afford it, just because that would be the best version of that car I could have. And, yeah, kind of like what you were saying with the Viper. I don't know if it was maybe a mix of all those things. And
yeah, like you're saying, though, the Challenger was reaching the point of Viper territory money. The Challenger was selling much hotter,
and they
much
knew
faster.
Where they were going to take the Challenger, because it got axed before the Hellcats came out, so I don't know. I do like to be hard on Chevy, but I got to give them all the credit in the world for having, you know, basically not only the intelligence, but kind of the courage to take one of the most iconic cars in the world is the Corvette name. And they took it and totally changed what Corvettes were. And yeah, some people are kind of hard on it, but those people are stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you've driven anything really high horsepower that is front rear, it is a handful. Like the Red Eye, you know, it's a handful of a car. But that was middle engined. Totally different.
Yep.
That's why the McLaren 720 works so well. You know, it's 720 horsepower in a car that weighs as much as the couch we're on. And the car works. that mid-rear platform is proven. McLaren, you know, has been doing it for a while now. Obviously, Ferrari and Lamborghini have made a career out of that. The Viper would have been the perfect car to take that name and flop that around before GM did it. They could have even kept the V10 because, well, the Audi R8, the Huracan, the Gallardo. I could rattle off 20 cars that have a V10, you know, midship, the Carrera GT. Plenty of cars have done it. There's no reason they couldn't keep that.
Yeah. I don't know if Dodge will have... I mean, they're a very ballsy company.
That's why I hope they will.
I hope they will, but... Man, I just don't... I don't know what to think. I don't know where it's going to go from here. Especially the Challenger platform. It's eventually going to get dated in everybody's eyes. It's going to start declining. I mean, right now it's not, and I'm extremely elated that, you know, it's outselling the Camaro and the Mustang.
It's just going to become familiar. You know, after a while, people are going to say, oh, it's just, you know, a really powerful car that does one thing well.
Right.
And the C8 kind of changed the status quo altogether because it moves out just as fast, but it also handles really well, and it looks exotic. I mean, a couple of C8s I have seen, they do. They look like an exotic car, and to most people who have never laid eyes on a Ferrari, it's a Ferrari to them.
Right.
It looks good, and GM really, they're basically offering a Ferrari level of performance that the middle class can truly afford this car. And, you know, it's just a fun debate because where does Ford go now? And where does Dodge go? The GT350 is really good, and I haven't driven a C8, but I already, in my mind, think the C8 is going to be better than the GT350. Middle-engine cars just, they work. They work really well.
I guess it's all going to depend, I think, on where the aftermarket takes the Corvette to.
Oh, it's going to go far.
Where that's, I think, what's going to be the deciding factor if other manufacturers follow suit. It's just going to be... I don't know. It's hard to say. From what I've seen, manufacturers developing these brand new platforms and having to spend all this money...
They watch the aftermarket. For sure.
Yeah, it's, I don't know. To me, the world has gone in the pot because everybody is just, has gone to that mindset of Toyota where they're just profit margin.
Yeah, BMW's proven that heavily.
So, it's hard to say. I am extremely optimistic that they won't go down that path, but something tells me that after this era of muscle cars is done, GM's going to be leading the way with the mid-engine platform car, and I don't really see Dodge following suit with a mid-engine car. I could see Ford following suit because they had the GT, but they would have to come in the game with something that's below the GT and somewhere above the GT500. And I don't see that happening. I do, but I don't.
Here's why I think Dodge has hope. And a lot of people are going to be like, what? Well, you heard it here first. I don't know if anybody has broke this news yet. Maybe they have, but I have gotten word, and I am green-lighted to say it, because I know somebody else will have already dropped it. But, so, Dodge is owned by Fiat. Chrysler, yada yada. Fiat owns Ferrari, Alfa Romeo. Well, now there has been a new merger, and again, I don't know if anybody else has announced it, so you might be hearing this here first, but this is a good segue to announce it. Alfa Romeo and Fiat have just done a 50-50 merger with Peugeot. So, Peugeot has been known to build some very unusual cars, including middle-engine cars. Alfa Romeo has built a few very, very good middle-engine cars. Ferrari obviously builds very good middle-engine cars. So now, Dodge is partnered with Peugeot, Ferrari, Alfa Romeo. That is a hell of a power corporation right there.
Mm-hmm.
obviously, we've seen a lot of that Alfa Romeo Fiat influence on Dodge products. I mean, look at the interior it's there without a doubt.
I don't care who you are. If you step into a new Dodge product and say that it has a crappy interior,
I have to disagree heavily.
Yeah, you are blind, or you're, I don't know.
New Alfa Romeos have killer interiors, and Alfa's heritage runs deep. The Montreal was middle engined. I mean, they've built a few, and I think that Peugeot merger not only gives them more money, but number one, we might see Peugeot back in the USA, which I'm hoping. But even more important, that's just more of that European influence that can trickle down to Dodge. So again, it's not just speculation. That is actual confirmed news. That merger did happen. I want to say, I think it went down last Wednesday, and I was excited to announce it here. But that is a definite thing. They're working out the rest of the details, but it's done. That merger has happened.
So Peugeot is now Mopar.
Yes, it is. Which is awesome because, again, we might see some smaller Dodge products come out of that. The Dart was an Alfa Romeo product.
And that's another thing where the Dart is a great platform, but it never really took off. They're in the beginning, it
kind of heavy cars.
It took off at the beginning, and I was seeing them getting modded, and then it was like it just ceased to be.
That's where I think the Peugeot thing will help out a lot. We might see some cars like the Dart with a Peugeot, you know, basically chassis and engine under it. I don't know yet. Nobody could confirm what might happen to Dodge with that, but I can tell you now it's not going to be anything bad. That's only going to benefit us, the consumer.
Might not see Dodge bring any kind of supercar out, but they may help influence, you know, something along the lines of an Alfa, or, you know, maybe stuff in a supercharged Hemi into some kind of Alfa, Ferrari, mid-engine, you know, something like that. I mean, that would be crazy off the wall, but...
Well, if for anybody who's like, oh, you guys are stupid, yada yada, here's a little, a very lesser-known fact that a lot of people do not know. The Maserati Ghibli, which unfortunately, because I love Ghiblis so much of old, the bi-turbo Ghibli, the old middle-engine Ghibli with the 4.9 in it, well, the newer Ghibli is very forgettable because it's built like shit. But everybody agrees they sound fantastic. What most people don't know is the F-160 engine in the Ghibli, wait for it, is based on the Chrysler Pentastar block. There you go. A lot of people don't know this. And Google it if you think I'm joking. It's a true story. So the F-160 was built by Ferrari using a Chrysler Pentastar block with their own heads. So for anybody who thinks those two wouldn't come together to build an engine, dead wrong, because they already did it. So an engine even like the F-160 put into a middle engine car makes a great deal of sense. Mm-hmm. It does rev well, even though it's a Pentastar block. It's still overhead cams. And it had Maserati and Ferrari's heads. Yeah, there's no reason they couldn't take that Hemi design and build an overhead cam out of it. And, I mean, the Voodoo is basically a Coyote that they did that with.
Yep.
You can do these things when you have that kind of engineering around you. So, I do think, in my opinion, if Dodge wanted to bring out a middle-engine car, and this is just my take on this, the perfect way to do it would be to take the engine, and I know you're going to enjoy this too, take the V6 bi-turbo out of the Giulia Quadrifoglio that's putting out like 600 horsepower, put that in a middle-engine car weighing under 3,300 pounds. I don't care if you call it the Viper. Right. I don't care what you call it. Middle-engine, rear-wheel, or even all-wheel drive with that engine, a dual-clutch gearbox, double wishbone suspension, or even inboard suspension if you really want to go hard. That car would be the perfect car to take on the Corvette and beat it while doing everything better.
They need to.
Could you imagine how that engine would sound, middle engine with an exhaust the length of my arm?
Right.
That would be pretty hot.
Oh, yes.
I know Alpha's talking about bringing the GTV name back. It might be the perfect way for them to bring the GTV back, because I don't think they'll sell it here. But if they bring it back and it is middle engine, that platform now becomes a Dodge platform.
Yeah.
That engine, if they bring the GTV back, they're going to do it just like they did back then. It's going to have the best V6 that they had available, which it did. Same one that was in the 75 and, you know, the 156. I'm sorry, the 164. That engine, that quadrifoglio engine in a middle engine car would be the perfect Dodge product.
Yes.
That's just my opinion. Come up with a cool name for it. I mean,
how do you think it would be received from everyone, where they're feeding everybody basically either gets a crossover from Dodge or a muscle car from Dodge? Where is it going to slide in on that spectrum?
I'll
where
tell
you're feeding your, you know, that whole entire genre of people. How are you going to offer that to get it to be able to, you know, be appealing?
I'll tell you how. Because there's, people don't realize it, but people like us, there's a lot of us out there. The same people who, you know, wanted Vipers, but now we don't have that opportunity, but now we're financially there to be able to do it. Or, you know, the people who do cross-shop 911s with, you know, GT350s. Those people do exist, without a doubt. So, people looking at the C8 Corvette, but they might not like that it's an LS. Or looking at the C8 and saying, I just don't know about Chevy build quality. Or I just don't like this about it. Well, it just gives them another product to immerse themselves in.
Mm-hmm.
And for the people like us who are highly educated, when the car comes out and they see, oh, that's got a quadrifoglio engine, it's middle engine, I'd like that. I think that car would sell on its own merit just because, yeah, we all worry about Alpha, you know, build quality. We worry about reliability. They're still selling the cars because it is that good of a car. To me, that middle engine, that a double clutch, or even the 8-speed would be fine. I wouldn't complain about that just for the quality. I think that car would sell really well, actually, as long as they didn't price it ridiculously. And I think the Giulia Quadrifoglio priced really well at, like, $75. To me, that makes more sense than an M3. So, the middle-engine car might come in at about $90. And, I mean, shit, I'd be interested, without a doubt. We're actually going to get ready to roll into part two. We're coming up on an hour, but hold that thought, everybody. All right, everybody, part two of the podcast. We were just discussing the Peugeot FCA merger, middle engine Dodge cars, and why they need to do it. I don't know, just fun conversation, things I think we might see. I think we're going to see a lot more hybrid cars for sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, Porsche has announced the next 5 years, I believe it was 5 years, that all 911s will be hybrid. So, I think we're going to see more of that trickle down from the European brands that have tighter sanctions, but, I mean, it's not like the EPA is being nice to us here either. So, either cars are going to have to get a lot lighter, or they're going to have to go hybrid to meet these crazy emission standards.
Right.
But,
do you see possibly, instead of a Dodge supercar, that maybe a sub-brand between, you know, Peugeot, Alpha, Ferrari, Dodge, everybody may make a sub-brand that would, you know, how Genesis kind of spun off possibly into a supercar that all of those make together to sell at a Dodge dealer possibly, or?
I mean, I could see that just because the Italians are kind of notorious for that. Obviously, the Alfa Romeos have the Quadrifoglio name for all their top models. Lancia did the HF, which was like their AMG, you know, with the elephant. So HF was a sub-brand of Lancia. Peugeot had one too, but obviously Fiat had Abarth, and they still do. Mm-hmm. That is a like tuning house for Fiat. So I wouldn't be shocked to see something like that.
That would be a perfect cue time to BBP or bring back Plymouth.
Yeah, I agree.
Since they filed for the CUDA moniker, they could, you know, offer a Plymouth, or I don't know necessarily if the Plymouth name really rings in today's society, but
I mean, don't be shocked if it's just an Abarth name car, because Abarth did produce their own middle engine car. I forget when it was, but they did have their own middle engine car, and obviously we have two Abarths now you can buy. Well, I don't know if the 500 Abarth is anymore, but the 124 Spider Abarth is still there.
Mm-hmm.
So I wouldn't be shocked if we seen just an Abarth branded middle engine car that maybe had some variation of a Dodge motor, like maybe a Pentastar reworked, or, you know, Alpha's got the 4C with that lovely four cylinder in it that's basically just a little bit bigger than the Darts engine. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't be shocked to see that happen. Or maybe they ground up designed a flat plane V8 that is, you know, inspired amongst Dodge and FCA. I think no matter what, speculation aside, I think it needs to happen by the next 2 or 3 years, or else Chevy's just going to just dominate that playing field.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, who else? The 911 is a sales giant. There's no question. The M3, obviously, is a very successful car. We don't have much to compete with those in terms of that right now. The 911 is basically unrivaled by Americans, aside from maybe the new C8. I think the C8, honestly, goes toe-to-toe with it and is better in a lot of ways. It's a lot more practical, technically, so
I don't know. I just don't see Dodge following the mid-engine, you know, platform. I just don't see it.
I don't think they've ever done it. I know they had that concept car back in the day. I forget the name of it. It had like a crossfire, like crosshair grill in it. It was middle engine. Players of Gran Turismo 2 will remember it. But it was a real concept car, and I forget what they called it.
Yeah.
But I mean, they had the Chrysler ME412, and I know people remember that. They actually built a couple examples of that. So Dodge wasn't necessarily behind, they just didn't have the balls to do it back then. The ME412 was a cool car. You know, it was 12-cylinder, 4-turbocharger, mid-engine car. I don't know why they didn't build it, but I do remember it. I just think that they're going to have to basically go back to that line of thinking. Chevy can't be the only one that has it. There's just no way. It doesn't make sense.
I think right now that Dodge is just doing so well in the muscle car market that they might stay there.
Yeah, that is true. But Chevy can't be the only one who has that market sector either. I mean, a lot of people critique Dodge. Oh, they're just a muscle car manufacturer. Well, Ford and Chevy both have been trying to catch up. The GT500 came out, obviously, with a crap ton of power. The ZL1 Camaro, crap ton of power, heavy car. I mean, whether or not they want to admit it, they're all trying to compete in that same market share. The Corvette has broke the internet. Honestly, the Supra launch really didn't mean much because of the C8. The C8 is what everybody's talking about. I just think somebody's going to have to basically admit they're almost imitating, but they're going to have to try. And it might be Ford. You know, Ford has done a couple weird cars like that, but I can't really think of anything production Dodge has ever done that had the engine anywhere but the front.
Right.
I really can't think of anything off the top of my head. But it's not just them anymore either. They are parting with the Europeans, and
mm-hmm.
Well, that's what they do. So it's going to be kind of fun to see what comes out of that. It's
definitely going to be interesting to see what the next 5 years brings, for sure.
I mean, when you look back to just 2015, you know, the market was very different than what it is now. Mm-hmm. I mean, crossovers have dominated, obviously. That's huge. It brought all these Hellcat cars. They brought the Ford GT back. You know, it came back, and obviously it's legendary. The Corvette having a change of engine location. New car, who dis? They yep. kind of pulled that. So, yeah, by 2024, this could be a much different conversation. Dodge, Ford, any of them could have this crazy new hypercar, basically. You never know.
Yep.
I don't think anybody really expected the Corvette to do what it did, but it was the right move, by far. kind of does make you wonder. This whole SEMA thing they tease just kind of had us on that, kind of wondering what is it going to be. Obviously, we know it's going to be a front rear car, but, you know, what's SEMA next year going to look like? Mm-hmm. What are they going to do to stay relevant, I suppose?
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, right now is the 50th, or, you know, next year is the 50th anniversary of the 70 Challengers, you know, the first year for the E-bodies, the Challengers and the Cudas, so.
They have to do something, yeah. I mean, 50 years.
Why not ride off of that?
Yeah, exactly. Dodge is very innovative in the way they do things, and they certainly have shown the world they don't really have limitation to how far they'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, you could buy a Red Eye with 797 horsepower, and 10 years ago, Dodge, you know, was making the Nitro. So,
yeah,
it's come a long way. I think the next 10 years could be good to them if they play their cards right. That relevancy thing is going to be important, because I do think, and it's nuts, but I think Chevy is going to steal customers from Porsche. I think they're going to steal, though. I really do.
Mm-hmm.
I think there's going to be people who drive both and say, well, the 911 might be more refined, but the Corvette is, you know, 40% cheaper. I think I'll take the Vette. And it's kind of hard to follow them. It's got a very proven, reliable engine in it. So as long as the cars don't catch fire for no reason, and they could, it's GM, but if they're put together well, you're going to see a lot of those around town. They are within reach. So it's hard to say. I hope we're right on speculation that...
Yeah.
We'll see maybe a mid-engine shootout amongst the big three. I think it'd be pretty cool, but
I don't see it happening.
It's hard to conceptualize that and have it make sense, because...
Yeah. Especially with what GM is going through right now, and the auto manufacturers in general, just what they are and aren't able to do financially, and what people are willing to spend money on versus what they aren't.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, sports cars are still, no matter what they are, whether it's a 911, whether it's a Viper, a Camaro, a Mustang, that is a niche market now.
Mm-hmm.
The big market is crossovers. So to have a middle engine, you know, Dodge sports car is a very, very niche market. Or even Ford, the GT was a niche market. Right now, all people really care about the mass market is, can I fit 5 people in here? Is it quick? Does it look cool? Okay. Everybody's migrated there.
Mm-hmm. And it's all these smaller companies, or, you know, Kia and Hyundai, that are profiting right now and are booming big time because their vehicles are affordable.
Yeah, I mean, it makes sense for Hyundai to have a Veloster in, because they sell enough Sonatas, they sell enough Santa Fes, they sell enough...
Elantras.
Yeah, they have that... It's funny, but yeah, Hyundai has all the money right now, for sure. They're doing real well. Companies like that can gamble a little bit more. Porsche obviously has a great deal of money. They sell enough Macans and Cayennes to build these crazy GT2 RSs, GT3s, that they have that kind of money. It's a little harder for the big three to be able to kind of throw their weight around that way, mm-hmm. for sure. It's more of a gamble for them than to say, oh, we failed, we tried. Porsche can get away with that.
Right.
Hyundai can get away with that. The crossover thing is kind of killing what we love, but it's hard to negate it because they've even gotten good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you drive a Macan or you drive, you know, just a basic Stelvio and they're great. It's like, yeah, I can kind of have it all with this.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, people like us, we want that flingable, tossable sports car.
I think in the northern, you know, half of the U.S. anyways, they're extremely usable because of the winters.
Yeah, it's a huge part of it for sure.
Now, if you're somewhere that's more tropical climate, it's easier to have a, you know, a sports car as a daily driver because you don't have to worry about driving it in inclement weather.
Yeah, I mean, if you live in Florida, it makes plenty of sense to have a Huracan or a Gallardo or inner, you know, great car here. Versus in Ohio, it's like, well, I have, you know, a nice Gallardo, but I have to put it away for basically a third of the year. Yeah, it's going away a while. Then, you know, if you have this beater car you don't mind driving around when it inevitably breaks, it makes more sense to buy a Stelvio Quadrifoglio because mm-hmm. it does all of those things, but it also goes through snow.
Right.
So, it can be hard to rationalize how we shop sometimes. I mean, there's no way around it. You don't want to drive a Corvette through the snow. It's not going to be a good ending, uh-huh. I don't think. You don't want to drive a Hellcat through snow. It definitely makes a compelling case against what we stand for, but at the same time, you can't ignore it.
Right.
I don't know where the market will go in the next 5 years for car enthusiasts. It might end up with us accepting that we're going to have a crossover that does it all well and just deal with it, or you're going to have a lot of money because at the end of the day, Pagani, McLaren, Lotus, they're always going to be around building these cars we like, but they go for premium money mm-hmm. because they're small volume. Ferrari's never going to quit building middle engine cars. Neither is Lamborghini. Neither is Lotus. None of those companies will stop doing what they're doing, but they'll have to have that huge car that booms those sales. The Urus, you know, the Stelvio, people building them, they have to have the one thing everybody wants.
Mm-hmm.
Not everybody wants a 488. It's not practical. It makes no sense.
Yep.
Yeah, I guess, again, just some of our speculation, not only about what does Dodge bring into SEMA, but where does it all go from here?
Yeah, it's hard to say. It's very... It can go lots of different ways.
Yeah, it really can. Well, shoot, I know you had a reader email. You want to dive into that?
Yeah, I'll get over that. We'll have a pretty decent little convo about afterwards.
Yeah, it was just something I kind of wanted to delve into.
Okay.
Alrighty.
This question comes from Al Salerno out of Hagerstown. Very familiar with Hagerstown.
Oh, yeah. We know Hagerstown real well.
Sorry I didn't get to cover this last week in our driving podcast, but I will send you a message here and let you know that we have actually replied to it. It says, hello there, Nathan. I've been listening to the podcast and I'm really enjoying it. You guys keep me laughing and the content is really great. I wanted to ask a few questions, actually, and I hope that is okay. Of course, you can ask multiple questions in, you know, emails. It's not a big deal. We love outside perspectives on, you know, our topics of stuff that we like to do. So
exactly.
Question number one. I have an Evolution 8 SSL, which those things are absolutely awesome. The SSL was what? Sun, Sound, and... Oh, I can't remember what it was exactly.
It's the rare one.
Yeah,
for sure.
It has the leather interior, the leather Recaros, the factory, better audio, and something else. But we had a friend that actually had one, that's a very nice Evo.
They are, for sure.
And it is about time for me to build my motor. I currently have the FP Red. I've been pushing on the stock bottom end. I've gotten high 10s out of the setup, as in quarter mile. I've gotten high 10s out of it, and I'm ready to take the car farther. I'm looking to go with a 64, 66, or similar, and do something different with the motor. I'm thinking of doing a stroker to make spool faster, but I also don't want to be locked into an engine that doesn't like to rev. I am shooting for a high 9-second street car and feel like the torque would be nice for driving. I'm also curious about doing a D-stroker just because I feel it will work well with a big turbo and the ability to rev and hold boost longer. What are your thoughts? My opinion is it seems like the combinations on these 4G63s have really been coming around where even 5 years ago, the combos that seem like they had to have a huge turbo to run nines isn't the case anymore. We're right. Seeing that, you know, a bolt-on FP Black onto an auto DSM that's running, you know, mid-eights. The 6466 is an awesome turbo.
For sure.
I mean, it'll definitely, you know, carry that capability of what you're wanting to go for, the nines. However, in the instance of, say, an FP Black or now the FP Zero, I think that smaller platform turbo will let you spool faster, you know, with the capabilities of tuning what software you're using and able to dial in your cams to be able to shift the power band, you know, either way that you want to be able to get it to spool quicker. If you want to utilize like your tunability, if you're on E85 or race gas, stuff like that. I think I wouldn't necessarily want a street car on race gas, but
right.
E85 for sure. I mean, you can really dial in a 2 liter. You can rev the crap out of one. I built one for my friend Bruce. That's a 2 liter, you know, steel rod. It's the Manly Turbo Tough rods. Molly, I think 9.5 to 1, 9.8 to 1 compression pistons. GSC 280 cams, old school Hover intake, Kigley springs, reworked ported head, and that thing very easily revs to 9 grand. And that's,
oh yeah,
I mean, it'll eat the tack extremely easy, and 2 liters rev very well. And that setup is on an old school red, and I mean, it is a front wheel drive car, so it is very spin and rev happy, wherein, you know, an all wheel drive, it would take a little bit of power away, but that's literally on like 25 pounds. And at that point in time, it was at like 30% E85 content, and it was logging almost 650 horse. So, on E85, an FP Black, a 2 liter, I would just build a 2 liter, maybe an aluminum rod if you wanted to rev it, you know, more than 10 grand. But I think that the Turbo Tough rod, I don't want to say it'll handle 10, but it'll definitely handle 9 grand. And if get like a ball bearing black or that Zero that spools by 4 grand, you got 5,000 RPM of usable power band. Where in his case, I think it comes on 4,500 to 5 and carries to 9. So, I mean, that's a pretty decent sized power band, and it really pulls very well. And I'm sure you can attest for how your car pulls already. But I definitely don't think that big turbos like a 64, 66 are necessarily needed to be able to make huge numbers like they were back in the day, especially, you know, you dial your tune in, utilize a good manifold with good spool characteristics, you know, especially in a bolt-on application, you know, FP turbo that will allow it to spool fast. Good head, you know, port work, good cams, get it to breathe. And not to say that a 6466 wouldn't be an awesome combo, because I know it would make, you know, your power numbers that you want it to. The 2-3 stroker, they are definitely capable. But if, like you're saying, you know, if you want to rev that engine, you're definitely going to go with like a D-stroker or just stay with a 2-liter because I know that they can rev like crazy.
Oh, yeah. 2 liters can rev real nice. I'm almost gonna put my input in on this.
Yeah, go for it.
It's gonna be a little different because everything Nathan just said is spot on. A 2-liter with a black wood, you could get 9s out of that for sure. No question. If your budget permits, I'm going to offer, I guess, how I think I would set it up for those goals, and that would be, I would go with the 2-1 D-stroker. I would do it with aluminum rods to play on that revability. I know there's some companies that make some killer aluminum rods that are supposed to be no stretch. And, yeah, I mean, it's going to be a little bit more expensive to set it up as a 2-1. But with aluminum rods, at that point, I would go with a V-band flanged GTX 35. And a normal GT35 is a 61 millimeter. I'm not quite sure the millimeter of the X, but it's a full billet turbo. I know the X actually is a little bigger, but it spools faster than the old GT35. Yeah, I think it's
the geometry of the wheel is actually different.
And I know Devin went 890 on a GT35, and I know GT35 cars spool very quickly, so I want to say a GT35 on a 2-liter spools by like 4,400. So I would think a GTX on a 2-1, I mean, obviously you're de-stroking. I think on the X you'd get 4,300. With aluminum rods, the appropriate Kigley springs, and just, you know, making sure you're not over-camming the car. You know, setting your cam profile based on what turbo you want to run. Some GSC S3s would probably be great for that. Doing your port work, I think you would have a 4,300, and that turbo would support the RPM for sure. I think you could take that to 9,800 quite safely with that turbo and have that fat power band. You're going to give up some of that around town torque with the D-stroker, but boost is always a downshift away. So
I think a lot of it's in the tune as well, because yes, especially if you, I don't know, playing around and seeing how people are getting these auto cars with these big turbos to spool, you know, without nitrous, there's a tunability workarounds to be able to give your car that torque and that ability to, you know, spool the turbo a little bit quicker for that drivability.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's some, if you're in Hagerstown, I mean, you're not all that far out of like New York, New Jersey. There's some really well-known shops out there that, you know, work with these cars. I forget what that one chap is, but I mean, they held the Evo record for quite a while. They're out of New York. Having somebody who can tune it properly is going to be a lot of it. But when I think of the perfect Evo, I always go back to a 2-1 with not too big of a turbo, but a turbo that will sustain with those RPMs. And I just think a GTX 35 with that spoolability, the ability to have enough airflow to, you know, go with those RPMs, I think that'd be like the perfect street car, honestly. And yeah, a 2-liter with a black would be a cheaper way to go, and I think it will net the same results. I think everything Nate said is dead on, and not only that, you'll get to keep your AC with the black. If you're running the GTX 35, you might have to get rid of your AC. You may have to remote mount your alternator. I mean, you might have to have that little bit of workaround because of, you know, you're not running a stock frame turbo anymore. You might
have, which would have been the same way with the 6466.
Exactly. No different. For me, I prefer the GTX over the 6466 just because they'll make roughly the same power, but that's just going to spool a little bit faster for sure. I mean, Garrett is the cat's ass when it comes to turbos for sure. But if you're wanting to limit your budget a little bit more, to put it into other ways, Nathan was dead on that all day. If you, you know, just want to kind of say you did it and be able to eat the whole tack, a 2-1 is not a bad way to go at all. You could literally be shifting that thing at basically your diff settings. And, you know, that's pretty cool. I think that'd be a blast for a street car. But a 2 liter with a black is, it's hard to negate how well that setup works.
It's simple and you can still rev it.
Yeah, I mean, for anybody who doubts it, just go watch Adriana Noonan's video from World Cup Finals. She literally spun through like first and second. She was pedaling the car completely sideways, still got it back straight, outran that Mustang, and she ran an 8.9, and she pedaled 330 feet easily.
I don't even know if she pedaled. She just,
she was in it. Yeah, she was just like
driving it.
Yeah, she was driving the wheels off that thing, and that's on a black. That's mm-hmm. on a black and an auto. So in an Evo,
and I have seen Tom personally messaging on like DSM pages on Facebook, guys talking about how, oh, they need this to spool a big turbo on an auto and all that, and he pretty much just told them, well, they need a better tuner. They need to know what they're doing. So
dead on.
The ability to spool the black on even an auto car, you know, isn't an issue. They're coming on to full boost, you know, a couple seconds onto the converter, and that's not, I don't even think it was like 2 seconds, so just under 2 seconds on the converter, and it was spooling, so.
Yeah, when I watched her video, she literally, because, yeah, that dude in that Mustang was being an asshat. He literally,
trying to burn her down.
Yeah, exactly. He got up to the light first to set the stage, so she didn't have much time to get up and stage, and it was maybe 2.5 seconds, and she was on the converter. Mm-hmm. So, without a doubt, people like to say, oh, the black doesn't spool as fast, because it is, I mean, by design, it's a Mitsu housing is more restrictive, mm-hmm. but in my opinion, if you want to keep, I know it gets real hot in Hagerstown in the summer, I'd want to keep my AC down there. I know it gets very hot. I remember very vividly the humidity and all that. A black would be perfect. I know I don't want to give up AC in my own build, so I think Nate hit it right on the head. But if you're going for a truly max effort car, D-Stroker is not a bad way to go. Mm-hmm. You could have a lot of fun with that. Just the sound those things make is truly ineffable.
Oh, yeah.
But 2.0s are proven. I mean, the fastest 4G63 powered cars always run a 2-liter displacement stroke. They don't modify any of that. I mean, as far as I know, Devin still runs a strictly a 2.0. I know very well Shepard always ran a 2.0. Mm-hmm. There was never any change to that. So it's hard to negate that the factory shit worked really well.
Mm-hmm. Yep, balance it really well, make sure that it's all jiving together really nice, and it'll rev. I know, like, on that 2G with the, I'm not even sure what crank it had in it. I want to say probably,
I think it had an Eagle.
Was it an Eagle crank?
I think so. I do think it was.
But it had the
aftermarket crank. That's a 6-bolt car.
Yeah, aftermarket crank. The Manly Turbo Tufts and those Mahle, M-A-H-L-E, or Mahle or Mala or something like that, depending on how you pronounce it. But those pistons, the GSC S3s, which are 280s, which they say are, I've heard from many people that it's overcammed for the car, but I mean, the setup works.
It does.
The old school Hover cast intake manifold with giant ports.
Works great.
Ported cylinder head, Kigley springs, pretty sure stock valves. I don't even think that they were an aftermarket stock size valve. I'm pretty sure they were a stock valve.
I think so. He's got a built trans in it, yeah. LSD. I mean,
that thing,
it's a build done right and it works.
Will rev to 9 like nobody's business. And I'm pretty sure that it would rev higher.
Oh,
if
would.
I knew that that bottom end was capable of taking those R's.
It
the head's
would.
Definitely capable, but
it definitely would. I mean, Andrew's car had the, you know, shitty BC 272s in it. I think he was on Evo Beehives on that.
Mm-hmm.
And he was running quite a bit of boost. A lot of people say, Evo Beehives and boost don't mix. Nah, I can tell you firsthand, it worked fine. He was his limiter was at 8,500, and he shifted a limiter, and it worked every time.
No doubt in the cylinder head being able to rev, because Kigley said those even their street springs are good for like 11 or 11.5.
Yeah. So. Oh, yeah, they'll go to the moon. As long as you're not running 80 pounds of boost through them, they will go to the moon.
Yeah, then you need to run the race.
Yeah, you have to set up your specific seat pressure based off of your basically intended boost. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, Kegley stuff works. I mean, if you don't already have a Kegley HLA, I would definitely get it very quickly. If you're going to be revving that high. A 2.0 with aluminum rods makes perfect sense to me, just because you're keeping the factory geometry. The aluminum rods will allow a little bit easier, happier revving. I know the aluminum rods balance out real nice. Mm-hmm. They're very congruent amongst cylinders. So, yeah. And that's the beauty of the 7 bolts. They offer some really wicked billet pistons for those things. I know the Yorkies Evo runs some billet pistons. Just get the weight out of the rotating assembly, and
yep.
Just, yeah, 2.0. They even offer billet cranks for Evo 7 bolt. You know, any of the, they're all the same cranks among 7 bolts. Yep. But those 7 bolts, they even offer the billet cranks, you know. So if you wanted to save your money in the D-stroker and truly solidify your 2.0, billet crank, aluminum rods, and good pistons you couldn't break that bottom end.
Even if you just consistently revved it to 10, then it's overbuilt for.
If you built your 2.0 like that, you comfortably could shift that thing at 10 as long as your gearbox allowed it at that point. Yeah. At that point, you're going to need a gearbox to do it. But, yeah, 2.0s can rev. I've seen them rev. I mean, my Talon's on all stock shit, and I think I've touched 7,800 with a bone stock quarter million mile car, and it was fine. It was enjoying life. So, 4Gs are definitely very good revers.
All right, moving on to question 2. How does Mitsubishi get their balls back and become a fun brand again?
That's a good one, actually.
Uh-huh. Which, this had my wheels turning in the simple fact of where you said Peugeot is now acquired by FCA, and it was speculated that the new Evo was going to be Peugeot powered.
Oh, that is right. That is true.
So possibly merging with Dodge, like they did, you know, Mitsubishi and Dodge back in the 90s to give us the DSM.
That would be dope.
May help bring Mitsubishi's balls back.
Fact of the matter is this. Nissan owns most of the controlling stake of Mitsubishi right now, and Nissan has not forgotten how to build good cars. I know there's haters out there, but the 370Z, it is an old platform now, and it's boring, but it's still a good car. The GTR is a phenomenal car, even though it's now old and familiar. I don't see any reason Mitsubishi shouldn't, number one, bring the Evo back. That just makes sense. Bring the Evo back. To me, what they need to do to prove they are still a player, and they can be, and I'm a DSM guy, but the car they need to bring back is the 3000 GT.
Mm-hmm.
That car needs to come back. They haven't had a true halo car like that since 99. I mean, with Nissan's help, again, Nissan owns controlling stake. There's no reason they couldn't bring back a 3000 GT using the GTR's lovely all-wheel drive technology. Because the GTR shown that weight doesn't matter when you're a GTR, because they are biblically heavy and they outhandle everything. So even if it's a 3,900-pound car like 3000s were, if it had the GTR's all-wheel drive technology, just basically a new spin on the 6G72 engine, you know, with today's turbo technology. Obviously, probably a double clutch transmission. To me, that's a car that would sell for 70 grand and actually be worth the money. I think that makes a ton of sense.
It does. However, Mitsubishi and Nissan technically being rivals, do you see Nissan allowing that to happen?
I think so, just because they have a big stake in it. The only person that's going to win off of that's both of them.
Right.
I mean, right now, their lineup looks like this. They have the Mirage, like I own, which in stock form is a very, very underwhelming car, but it's a great driver. hardly an exciting car. The basic Lancer, which is about as boring as watching paint dry. The Eclipse Cross, which could have been cool had they had not named it the Eclipse and gave it more power, because it is boosted, and boosted is always fun unless you're an Eclipse Cross, because the CVT just kills all that. So, in my opinion, rename the Eclipse Cross, for God's sakes. You have a good platform there. Rename it, give it the 8-speed ZF that's in everything now, and give it about 125 more horsepower, and that car already makes sense. You can fix the Eclipse Cross with those two things. Then you need to have the real Eclipse back. There's no reason they shouldn't. Hyundai is still using a 4B11 derivative engine. It's still there, and it still passes emissions. Yeah, it's not a 63, but now, I'm not going to hate on a 4B11. They work well.
Mm-hmm.
They work real well. So, 4B11, 340 horsepower to compete with the 3 Series cars. There's your Evo. Or there's your Eclipse. Maybe make it 300 horsepower in the Eclipse. All-wheel drive, double clutch. I'm cool with that. All-wheel drive, done. That's how you make Mitsubishi fun again.
Mm-hmm.
And then take the fucking Mirage and just slap a small turbo on it. Offer a rally art version of it, because there's actually demand for that. It's been discussed. Plenty of owners are like, hey, if they had a rally art of this, I'd trade mine in and buy it. And yeah, I get it. Even if it's still front-wheel drive, they already offer it in a manual. So a 5-speed, 140-horsepower Mirage would be a fun, you know, alternative to other hot hatches. Lower it an inch and a half in the factory. Throw some better roll bars on it. Needs more aggressive seats. Even if that was a $21,000, $22,000 car, it's a good rival to a normal turbo Veloster. Makes sense. No reason they shouldn't do that. The Mirage was always a fun car. Bring that back. Spruce that up. Still offer your basic, you know, just normal SE, ES, and GT, but then offer the rally art with about 140 horse. You don't need much more in that car's weight. That would be a great car people would actually buy, I guarantee it. Not only that, you're not really going to hamper fuel economy putting a turbo on it. It seems to help fuel economy with everybody, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Keep the 3-cylinder, bring the Eclipse back, 4B11, all-wheel drive, take the Eclipse Cross and call it something else. 100 more horsepower, 8-speed. Great. That's a hell of a crossover at that point.
Make a 3000.
Make the 3000, bring the Evo back. That right there is a lineup that is what Mitsubishi used to be. Mm-hmm. They used to have cool cars like that. They had the 1G and 2G DSMs that did real well in sales. They had the Evos that were killing sales and doing great in rally. As far as crossovers, they always had good ones. They had the Pajero. They had the AirTech, which had an Evo 4G63 in it. Those things were sweet. I mean, God, they had other really cool cars back then. Mitsubishi used to have some of the coolest cars. Just look back on your history and don't forget who, you know, where you came from. That's how you always forget where you're going.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
It's not hard to revive them. The passion has always been there. They just need that direction. I don't know how they got where they are now, but they need to, like, get off that course. That's a good question, though.
Yep, that's awesome.
I mean, what do you think? Does that not make
all the
sense?
Yeah, I mean, I don't have any... I actually didn't even think of the 3000 GT, you know. Even take it and base it off of the GTR platform, you know, that's aged... And, you know, platform share it with that. Call it the 3000 GT, but, you know, put its own bespoke engine in it.
Yeah, I mean, Nissan's going to end up, obviously, going to the R36 before too long. So, why not do what Fiat and, you know, Mazda did? And, oh, here, you know, you can use...
Here's my hand-me-down.
Exactly, here's my hand-me-down. Build your Fiata. And, mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, if you had that basically GTR architecture, you could put your own body and engine in it. Shit, utilize the GR6 trans. Mm-hmm. Utilize that killer all-wheel drive system. Now you're not necessarily in GTR airspace because you're in their older car that's still 90 million times better than anything else Mitsubishi has.
Right.
I don't see any reason they shouldn't do that. To me, that is how you take your old, you know, GTR inventory and you spruce it up with a brand you have interest in. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's a very feasible way to do it.
However, will they do it? Probably not.
Here's the 3000 GT. You cannot tell me enthusiasts wouldn't take a liking to that.
Yep.
Makes all the sense. 3000 GTs were always so cutting edge when they were out.
And that's exactly why it wouldn't happen, because it's a plain common sense solution.
Yeah, no, exactly. They have forgotten how to do these things. Do you have any other questions?
Nope, that was it.
I mean, I kind of think that's a good place to close it out on. I mean, between the mergers we're seeing going on, the current way the market's going, the middle engine thing, Mitsubishi trying to revive itself, building a fast Evo. This was definitely a fun podcast for sure. So on that note, everybody who has projects like my shitbox Mirage, don't forget to modify, maintain, and drive your cars.
Yep, absolutely.
Have a good one, everybody.
See ya.